Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and an audio tour that this week brings us from the musical foment of 1960s Manhattan to the patisseries of present-day Paris by way of a photographic record of Donegal and a very specific definition of quiet in Cork. But we start with that question of what is just in intonation and attribution. Our regular correspondent, University of Oxford Professor of Composition Jennifer Walsh, is a champion and a former collaborator of the late American composer Tony Conrad. Conrad was a pioneering artist who, alongside Lamont Young, was one of the members of the Dream Syndicate, an innovative 1960s ensemble with a huge but complicated legacy in music, one that for a long time saw Conrad unable to control his own music. Jennifer Walsh recorded an album with Conrad in the last years of his life in 2016, which has just been released, so Culturefile asked her to introduce us to the sounds and the enduring musical ideas of Tony Conrad for a special program we'll be broadcasting next month. But this time, we're going to have an introduction to that introduction to Tony Conrad.
Because everybody is so used to hearing Steve Reich and Philip Glass, you know, and those tracks, like I remember reading an interview with Philip Glass in NME back in the 90s, and it said he was the highest paid composer in the world. So that's sort of what I would call like really crisp, clean, rhythmic minimalism. That's become what we think of when we talk about minimalism. But I'm really interested in, you know, what Tony was doing, because there's something even rawer. You know, it's going back even further. It's saying, okay, let's strip even more away until we're just there with raw sound. And I think that's something really special. Tony was born in 1940, so he's in New York in the 60s, you know, and he's like a young guy in his 20s. I knew him when he was in his late 60s and early 70s. So when I'm talking about Tony in his 20s, I'm also sort of thinking back through time of how I knew him and the stories that he would tell me about that time. So he was sort of in this very creative world. And legend has it that he had a book called The Velvet Underground, and Lou Reed saw that, and that's how the name of The Velvet Underground came to be.
And actually, if you listen to Tony Conrad's own music and you're familiar with The Velvet Underground, you do hear a lot of the same seeds, maybe.
Oh, definitely. I mean, when I hear The Velvet Underground and I hear John Cale's viola drones, I think of Tony. Okay, so I would have listened to The Velvet Underground before I listened to The Dream Syndicate, or what's also known as the Theatre of Eternal Music, this group that consisted of Lamont Young, Marion Zazila, John Cale, and Tony Conrad doing these long-form drones together. He had studied maths, and so when he started playing with Lamont Young and John Cale and Marion Zazila, Tony was very interested in just intonation tuning. For anyone who's unfamiliar with the term, just intonation tuning is actually the natural way that notes are tuned. So if you play up an empty pipe, you play up these different harmonics, whereas when you play the piano, everything's been tuned to sort of fit into what we call equal temperament, 12 chromatic notes per octave. That was something he brought to the group. And Lamont Young, who's still alive, minimalist composer, Lamont Young was also interested in these sort of just intonation relationships. And so when they were improvising with the group that came to be known as either the Dream Syndicate or the Theatre of Eternal Music, they were using these just intonation intervals to drone for very long periods of time, because if you really tune things properly like that, you get all these beautiful harmonics and overtones above. So when I hear The Velvet Underground and I hear the drones, and even when I hear Nico, those amazing, amazing albums that John Cale did with Nico, I hear that influence of these drones and these pure number relationships. And so certainly when I hear this recording, Inside the Dream Syndicate, Volume 1, Day of Niagara, you get this sense of what they were doing together as people, you know, and you can sort of hear what was happening, and you can even hear these drones that you're going to hear in The Velvet Underground, that you're going to hear in Nico's solo albums that she did with John Cale, that you're going to hear in Tony's music. So you can see this was sort of a common concern. This recording is supposed to have been recorded on the 25th of April, 1965. And then it was released by Table of the Elements, who's a fantastic label that actually released a lot of Tony's music later on down the line.
This was all happening in the context of a kind of a really vibrant new music scene in Manhattan at the time. But it sort of turned out rather unhappily because obviously Lamont Young and Tony Conrad had an awful lot in common, and John Cale as well, with how they felt about music. But that turned out to be a problem.
It really is heartbreaking in that you had a scene where you had people, and at the time they were in their 20s, you know, they're young people and they're improvising together, and the different people involved in those sessions consider it improvisation. John Cale has said he considered it improvisation, a group improvisation, something that they created together. So has Tony. Tony said it many, many times. But ultimately, the person who pressed record on the tape recorder and who had the tape recorder was Lamont Young. And so Lamont Young at a certain point said he refused to release any of these recordings unless everybody signed a document saying that they were actually compositions by Lamont Young as opposed to group improvisations. And Tony talked a lot about this time in his life as a time where he really felt he wanted to get rid of composition. That's the phrase he used to use, that he felt like composers were outdated, and it was about what Christopher Small would call musicking. It was about people together making music. And you sort of have this beautiful vision of group improvisation, and then that comes crashing down when Lamont Young says, well, retrospectively, I'm calling these my compositions and I'm not going to let you have access to the tapes. Four Violins fits in chronologically, but it's also proof that this sort of sound world that the Dream Syndicate were playing in, that Tony was also doing it independently, because Four Violins, the legend has it, is a recording that Tony made by himself in 1964, trying these different drones out. To me, it sounds exactly like Tony, this very overdriven sound on the violins. But it didn't surface until the 90s. It was proof that this world of just intonation and drone, that this was something that Tony was doing independently. So it's sort of an artistic vindication. You know, fantastic drone music, really overdriven like rock music is. You know, like a rock music guitar would be full of all these different tones and harmonics from this gorgeous just intonation tuning, this world that you can just melt into. And I didn't know immediately, this is also this sort of vindication of this decades-long, you know, argument between the members of the Dream Syndicate and Lamont Young as to who had a stake in this music.
Jennifer Walsh there on the sound world of the late composer Tony Conrad. And you can hear the full version of that programme in the Culturefile weekly slot on Saturday, August 3rd. Four decades of Donegal life, one frame at a time. Next, Declan Doherty created his massive archive of everyday life in Donegal in his career as a photographer with local paper, the venerable Donegal News, where he turned up for work in 1979 and only retired last year. As part of this year's Errigal Arts Festival, the County Museum is showing a sampling of Doherty's album of Donegal life. Culturefile's Vanessa Noonan went to see the show with the man behind the shutter, Declan Doherty.
That is the Donegal News, Jerry Peeps. They've amalgamated
it. All right, well, I'll this on.
The tongue's wagging, I suppose.
My name's Declan Doherty. Former Donegal News photographer. Sometime before I finished up, there was a few of us in the office and we sat and we started to count how many publications of digital and traditional newspapers there were in the county. And I think we got up to possibly 13 or maybe 14, which is absolutely huge. And a lot of those are still the traditional type local newspaper that you would see in the newsagents on a Thursday or Friday. The Donegal News first published, I think, about 112 years ago, so it's on the go a long time. And they publish an edition on a Monday and an edition on a Thursday. So there's quite a lot going on. Like traditionally when I was growing up in Letterkenny, my dad would have bought the Donegal News, but he would have traditionally bought that paper for the Letterkenny and Donegal News, and he would have bought the Derry Journal as well to find out what was going on in Derry. Oh, the local newspapers here cover absolutely everything, especially now. Everything that moves in the county is literally covered, and things that don't move. They cover all the local news. They cover breaking news stories. Sometimes the story is a wee bit more tragic than the other. They cover a lot of human interest features. You do first days at school, there would be communion photographs, confirmation photographs, fairs and Irish dancers, and you name it, it's all in there at one time or another,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, so a lot of these stories as well, like this, we would have covered over the years. This is a primary school, but this particular story, we were invited to the school because they were using this bathroom as basically as a classroom, because they'd know they needed more space, they had more pupils, they needed more room. They were campaigning to get an extension built, but while the process of the extension was going through, the application process was going through, they were actively using this bathroom area here as basically as a classroom.
So I guess, yeah, like, in writing about it would have helped or been part of that.
Well, they wanted that highlighted in the newspaper, and then that would give the local politicians then a wee bit more impetus then to bring that case to Dublin to lobby the TDs and maybe the Minister for Education and stuff, you know. So thankfully that was all sorted out eventually, and it's a great school, you know, it's a great school.
I started in 1979, and so I was there for just over 40 years. Well, I was only 18 at the time. One of the requirements, this was even from very early days in the job, was that you could drive and that you had a car. So I was lucky that I did have. So, like, I was setting off from Letterkenny in the car, heading for maybe places that I'd never actually been before. You know, way west of the county, Guidoor, Burtonport, Donegal Town, way up around then Columkill and north of the county. But we tried to plan it in such a way that maybe a reporter would go out with me and we would pick up on a specific story possibly, but we'd pick up maybe three or four different stories.
Know what the stories were.
Sometimes we would, and then sometimes we'd pick a day during the week where, let's say, maybe a Thursday or Friday when it was a bit quieter, and we'd just head off somewhere. And we just start talking to people and trying to find out what was going on. You know? It was great. It was great fun because there was you really weren't in contact with the office. Once you left the office, that was pretty much it, because there was no phones, no mobiles. If you wanted to ring back to the office to say where you were or what time you'd be back at, you had to go and look for a phone box or a phone somewhere, you know. So, and then of course, realistically, you had to try and justify your time as well. So you had to sort of talk to people, try and find out what was going on, what was happening in the local areas, and try and make maybe a bit of a news story or a feature or something.
This is so good as well. The postman.
Yeah, that was Seamus Mulligan, a local postman.
Whereabouts is that?
That is between, that's the road between Falkara and Gortahork. It's quite a cycle, even on a good bike, but that looks like a very heavy bicycle.
Which is, how
which
many
is, would be.
Say?
10 or 15 kilometres, maybe?
God, yeah.
Yeah. So he's got his post bags in the front of the bike in a basket.
And a big smile on his face
as well. A big smile on his face as he's coming up the road. I'd say he was a very fit man. So that would have been taken, as we were saying earlier, that would have been taken maybe when I was out maybe doing a job somewhere. And on the way back, I would have noticed him coming towards the car or something. Maybe, and I would stop him. That's a likely picture that we possibly would have used, because the Donegal News in particular was known for using maybe a more offbeat, quirky shot on the front page. So we probably likely would have used that maybe on the front page that week.
Okay. Now, we didn't really cover much on the islands. It would need to be very, very, very specific for us to go to the island. One of the things that actually what we did cover on the islands was the elections. Every time there was a general election, generally speaking, the islands voted the day before so that they could bring the ballot boxes back to the mainland on the day of the main election on the mainland. So it was great experience to go out with the ferry, and they brought the ballot box out to the island, say out to Arranmore, Inishbofin as well, I think. And the Garda and the returning officer would accompany the ballot box on that. When I say a ferry, now this could be a very small a very small boat. And then, of course, when the boat would pull in at the pier, the actual voting place would be maybe a kilometre. So the Garda and the returning officer would have one hand on each side of the ballot box and carry it across the beach. And sometimes there was only maybe half a dozen people on particular islands there to actually vote. So the whole thing was done and dusted, and we all headed back in the boat then to the mainland fairly quickly. The county's changed enormously since I started working. Things are much better now than they were, let's say, in the early 80s. The 80s were sort of, kind of seemed like a very long, dark period, you know, and it was kind of shortly after I started working for the paper as well. So advertising and all that sort of stuff was a little bit depressed, and businesses were having trouble. So everybody was just kind of going from one day to the other, you know. But now when we came back, when we got out of that, and from the 90s and into the 2000s, things started to pick up enormously. You know, it's much better place to live now than it was at the time, you know.
I'd say probably taking pictures of most people in Donegal at this point.
A good few, yeah.
Jacqueline Doherty there, guiding Vanessa Noonan through Life Through the Lens, an exhibition of 40 years of work with the Donegal News, which is at the County Museum in Donegal. In the city of light and buttery pastry, a change has come. In Paris, where the methods and ingredients of the traditional croissant are guarded by hyper-vigilant fraternities, such as the Union of Bakers of Greater Paris, a new type of boulangerie has emerged, using centuries of know-how to create cruelty-free, butter-free croissants and other patisseries. The sector was celebrated recently at a plant-based food festival in Paris, where the pioneering vegan bakeries and patisseries came to show off their wares, and McCluskey went to meet and eat with some of the bakers on the battlefront.
Un croissant, un café crème, ça remplace les je t'aime. Quand au sortir de son lit, on est seul dans la vie.
Like, this is way better than a regular croissant, because you actually have way more texture.
Had you not told me that it was plant-based, I wouldn't have guessed it.
Aujourd'hui, pas de moustache, pas de bedaine, pas de tache, mais pour me...
So for the RFS, we have an enormous number of customers. We had prepared 100 vegan sandwiches. So the RFS started at 11 a.m. and customers were already waiting from 9 a.m.
I'm meeting with Véronice Lecomte at VG Patisserie, one of the pastry shops participating in the fest.
So we gave all our 100 sandwiches in 16 minutes. It's an absolute record.
Véronice is the pioneer of plant-based patisserie in France. When she launched in 2016, she encountered rather negative reactions.
Pastry is it's very precious for French people, and vegan pastry is with no dairy, no eggs, so it's a little strange. For example, the flan, it's a French pastry, and we receive some messages who tells, oh no, you don't have the right to call that a flan because it's not a flan. I think now vegan lifestyle, once considered a trend, is now becoming more established. People are changing their consumption habits, and we can see in VG Patisserie, because we have a lot of non-vegan customers.
Serre aujourd'hui mon café noir, pleuré fille des magazines, femme mûre dans vos cuisines, la plus belle dans son miroir.
Right around the corner, I'm snatching a few minutes of Rudolf Landemann's time at Land and Monkeys. His organic and plant-based bakery was launched early 2020, just before the outbreak of the pandemic.
Super timing.
When he put this idea down on paper with his team back in 2015, it was pure utopia.
It's not so easy in the country like France to change the mentality, of course, because vegan is a new concept for French people. But because we focus about taste, we continue to keep the French spirit of the bakery, but we make it enter in the 21st century.
Pierre Hermé, pâtissier chocolatier, the inventor of la haute pâtisserie, often called the Picasso of pastry, has also taken the plant-based route. In the preface of his recently published book, Pâtisserie Végétale, Pierre Hermé says he surprised himself when he discovered infinitely delicious creations. He had to not only reimagine the recipes, flavors, and techniques, but also to invent a new gourmet language. When I met with him in his elegant and colorful office in Paris, he serves us both one of his recent creations that he imagined for his plant-based line, Un Jardin Enchanté. To take his own description of the tart, it's the contrast between the lime plant-based cream and the warmth of the espalette chili pepper, then the punctuation brought by the liveliness of the fresh raspberries, topped with lime gelée, that makes it delicate and delicious.
It's not a radical move, it's more for me a creative opportunity. So to work on a field that I don't know very much and to learn and to create some techniques, tastes, or textures that are new or that different from the way we do pastry originally.
This is all part of the evolution of the history of French pastry. I was daring enough to ask Pierre Hermé if he could tell us how he came up with the subtle harmony of flavors for his signature creation, Ispahan, in the name of the rose.
The beginning, I discovered the flavor of rose with the Bulgarian cuisine, and that gave me the envie to use rose. So I did a first cake that was called Paradis. Was rose and raspberry. And finally, I come up with the lychee because of a tasting of an Alsatian wine called Gewürztraminer. I discovered that Gewürztraminer has rose and lychee taste. So for me, it was the following combination, rose, lychee, and raspberry. And that's in 97, I create the Ispahan.
You can now choose from a traditional Ispahan croissant or a plant-based one. The Parisian bakery and pâtisserie scene is diversifying and moving on for a new generation of consumers seeking something else, but with kinds of kindness.
Anne McCluskey there with some of the bakers at the Erta plant-based festival in Paris. And finally on the Culture File Weekly, Some Like It Quiet. The Quiet Music Ensemble is a Cork-based group of musicians who specialise in playing, well, quiet music, with a capital Q. Quiet music, as our guest this time, Quiet Music Ensemble's John Godfrey suggests, is more than just a rejection of loudness. It's a philosophy of sound, composition and performance that might help us rethink what music is. The Quiet Music Ensemble have just released We Return to Ground, an album of music by Karen Power, the composer we last heard from on our Cicada Safari, and John Godfrey spoke to Culture File about the quiet music therein and about a musical journey into quiet.
I don't enjoy high volumes anymore, but of course when I was young and involved with Icebreaker and even the early days of Crash Ensemble, I did. And there's more to volume than just loudness, because of course there's the physical effect of loud sound. And people who go to rock concerts, part of the experience is just the visceral impact of, you know, like the bass drum hitting you in the chest and you know, being deeply buried in this sound. There's something very particular that happens when sound is especially loud. And it isn't just to do with being deafening. You know, it's to do. There's a psychological element. There's a physical element, and so on. My journey has most definitely been from the loud to the quiet over my life. That's not true of everybody. The things that the kind of quietness that we're talking about when we're talking about quiet music ensemble is not just a question of quiet volume. It's also a question of quiet mind. That quietness is associated with the rejection, I think, of a number of things that you are more inclined to be interested in when you're younger. For example, our music makes no attempt to be exciting, to be stirring, to be expressive, to be dramatic or gestural or, you know, any of these things. Our music is really about a completely different sort of experience. So it doesn't need to shout, it doesn't need to attract your attention. If you're not going to listen, then you're just not going to listen. It's fine.
On some level, it's a recalibration, because once you start listening to a piece, it's as full of incident and dynamic as any other piece of music, or, you know, a loud piece of music. All of that is there. It's just about an attempt to recalibrate, maybe.
To an extent, yeah. I mean, there was an interesting comment from somebody after our gig in Berlin, where they said that they realised that the music was was as intense as it would have been if it had been loud. Because it's the sound that is intense, not the volume. And there's also a very interesting thing that people don't think about, and I often use this example, because quietness, just like loudness, is a great deal more than just not being loud. Consider rhetorical devices. I mean, I can make my point emphatically by talking loudly and banging the table. I won't bang the table because the mic is on it and it'll sound horrible, but, you know. But I can also make the point by speaking slower and more quietly. And, you know, you can feel the way that you get pulled into the statement as that happens. Quietness brings you into a state of listening, a state of mind that is very intent, very focused, very open to whatever's there. Part of this for me is a reaction against a type of music which I spent my life making, which shouts at you. Pretty much all the music that we have in the West, classical or pop or anything else, expects you to be a receiver, not a participant. So you sit quietly in your classical music concert, or if you go to a rock concert, the music is at such a volume that, you know, you can scream and shout and dance and all the rest of it, but you won't experience anything else because the music overrides all of the other noise you might be making, or the noise the environment might be making. The music governs your experience. There's a fantastic word in Japanese, mushin, which is associated with Zen Buddhism, but also martial arts. It's often translated as mind as no mind. Now, what it doesn't mean is sitting there like a lump and, you know, sort of thinking nothing and being nothing. What it means is the ability to really experience what is happening without colouring it with your desires, your emotions, your ego. You know, so you are really mindful, fully open-minded. This is really the sort of place I'm interested in musically. I don't want a music that tells you what you should be feeling, or even tells you exactly what you ought to be listening to. Sometimes I call it post-music or sort of something like that. It's also impossible for a Westerner to achieve.
Quiet Music Ensemble's John Godfrey there on The Power of Quiet, and the Quiet Music Ensemble album Karen Power, We Return to Ground is out now on Other Minds Records. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back next week with our special programme with Jennifer Walsh on the music of Tony Conrad. That's next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.